An incentive changes your behavior. A reward thanks you for being a contributing part of the operation. Profit-sharing plans are rewards. Nobody changes their behavior at the office because they're on a profit-sharing plan. Nobody says, I'm only grabbing one donut because that second donut will go to the bottom line and then I won't get a profit.
You're listening to Sunnyside Up, a B2B podcast that brings you the juiciest insights from go-to-market leaders and practitioners.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Sunnyside Up podcast. I'm your host, Devin Cohen, and today I'm super excited to talk to Eric Charles on a journey to leadership and insights from a marketing evangelist. With over 30 years of experience in marketing, consulting, and solution evangelization, Eric has cultivated a deep passion for bridging the realms of sales, marketing, and engineering to propel the advancement of revenue and incentive management. As the chief evangelist at Exactly Corp, his role involves collaborating with partners, analysts, and academics to deliver seamlessly integrated solutions across the spectrum of revenue intelligence, sales performance management, and employee motivation. In addition to Eric's substantial consulting and research background, he's honed his focus on crucial metrics for sales and marketing folks, customer acquisition and retention roles, and the design and communication of incentive plans. Holding certifications as a quote-to-cash professional, Eric is recognized as a subject matter expert in the interconnected realms of revenue intelligence, performance, and optimization. Eric, super excited to talk with you today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. And so, Eric, to kick us off, would love if you could walk us through your professional journey a little bit and talk about your background in sales and in product and partner marketing and how that sort of helped to shape your to eventually becoming a marketing leader at Exactly.
I laugh. Shaping the path makes it sound like it was a conscious decision at all times. I moved to Los Angeles following my wife as she started a PhD program at USC, which meant I left Silicon Valley where I had a job offer at Apple Computer and I'd already done some work for them. I actually did educational marketing and sales for them up in Alaska, where I helped push early Macs into the University of Alaska Anchorage and the local school system. So suddenly I find myself in LA and I need a job. And I happened to be on the USC campus one day, just visiting my wife, and stopped by their career center. And there was a post up on the board for a management consulting firm. I had no idea what that, I mean, we all knew what management consulting was, but I didn't know. But I sent them my resume and ended up getting an interview with a small. So I walked into the career center at USC, believe it or not, and there was a sign on the wall of a consulting firm that wasn't doing on-campus interviews but wanted resumes. So I sent them my resume and said, hi, I'm a recent graduate of Stanford University. This looks interesting. Yada, yada. Sent them my resume, got the interview, and it was a company that designed incentive plans. So they did board pay, executive pay, and sales pay. And I fell in love with it. It was spreadsheets and all this stuff. So I spent several years doing that and then moved back to the Bay Area where Sun Microsystems, who was one of my customers, asked me to come in and run compensation for a division. And this is before Sun was part of Oracle. It was the glory days of Scott McNeely. The network is the computer. He was very patient in seeing where this was all going, just not quite there yet. The web had just come out. And then Calidus came and pitched me their sales compensation solution. And I asked them a core question. I said, does this run on Sun Solaris Unix system? They said, no, it's on Windows NT. I said, well, Scott McNeely will kill me if I bring in a Windows product into Sun Microsystems at this point. This is in the 1990s when the Neely-Gates feud existed. And so I said, so instead, why don't you hire me? And they brought me on board and I got to help design the product. So this is when I got started to really get my hands dirty with what does it take to design out a product to fulfill a business need. It was very interesting to me. And while at Calidus, I mean, I did product marketing officially. I built out an alliances program with them. And then I also closed a deal in Sydney, Australia, because none of the sales team wanted to have to get up and chase it. And I joked, I was Mikey from the old Life commercial. I don't want to do this. I don't know. Give it to Eric. He'll do anything. And I want to emphasize that do anything. And that's how I kind of built out my career. Whenever something interesting comes along, I'm like, oh, I'll take a shot at that. So I did. I booked a meeting. I flew down to Australia. I worked with this bank and got them on board. I also met with some of the big global SIs and convinced one of them to do the full implementation, to get trained and do the implementation and make it happen. And so that got me interested in alliances work even more. So did that for a few years, left in those days in Silicon Valley. The trick was you did 2 years at a company at a time. You get 50% of your options and move on. That seriously was like an openly discussed strategy to protect oneself and build up your bank. And Calidus would later go public. And I always say is I made a little bit of money off of that. Didn't complain, but certainly didn't retire. And then from there, I worked for a couple other companies, another acquisition, and started a company with some friends. And then I got approached by the University of California, Irvine's Palmerage School of Business. And I was a graduate of their executive MBA program. They asked me to come and said, hey, would you take this over? We kind of need a turnaround here, which is really, again, a sales and marketing thing. So when I was at Calidus, I understood the need of the product because I designed incentive plans. And then when I went over to the university, I had been a student. I knew what the executive students were looking for, so I could run that program. And so I did some programmatic changes, not pedagogical. That's the world of the faculty. But the programmatic changes I could do to make a better program that better fit the needs of the students. And again, by having been one, I had a very good feeling for it. Plus, I had a great advisory board of my classmates, and I would regularly talk to them. I did that for several years, did a couple of things, and then Exactly called me up. And Chris Cabrera, the founder, CEO of Exactly, along with Satish, Chris had worked with me at Calidus. I remember when he was hired as our first sales rep, and I would go out and do sales calls with him. I wore the hat of a sales engineer for those in the demos. And so he asked me to come do Exactly and kind of do whatever. And I was excited about it, about the data that they had. So then 12 and a half years of working at Exactly, same idea, built up the product marketing function and would hand it to somebody else, build up an alliances function, hand it to somebody else to manage, build up. And then I've built up the evangelism function. And I think that's one that a lot of companies don't quite know how to embrace. And one of the biggest challenges I've seen in my career, and I do advisory services to startups and a couple accelerators and a couple venture funds. And I mainly go in to help. I'm always interested in helping really smart engineering-led companies know how to take their baby and put it in the hands of sales and marketing. Because that break between a great programmer, a great product designer, to then into somebody who needs to represent all of your work for 5 years, let's just say. I hate to break it to you. I need to summarize this down to three really good SEO bullets just to get someone's attention and then build off of that. They're like, but you have to say more. We will say more, but we can't. And by the way, you're the founder CEO. You need to stop selling. You need to be willing to hand over. As a matter of fact, what I think one of the most interesting pieces of economic research a while ago, or is interesting to me, I guess, was Hart and Holmstrom got the prize in honor of Alfred Nobel. There is not a Nobel Prize for economics, I know, for anybody listening that wants to counter me on that. Just let's call it the Nobel for economics. But Hart and Holmstrom got it for principal agent theorem, which is really when a company accepts risk in exchange for the return of having a sales team. And it's all math and it's fascinating. It's a utility function. And we could go into that at some point, but I need a whiteboard and a few minutes and an extra cup of coffee and that sort of a thing. But I feel that is so critical, especially in the software industry or the technical product industry, of taking on that risk of letting somebody else represent you, the agent, as you as the principal, because you cannot exponentially increase the output of a founder CEO talking to prospective clients. But what we can do is if we can train them properly and enable them and motivate them, we can give it to a sales and marketing team. And I roll the two together because one of my favorite questions I get from people who aren't in business is, what's the difference between sales and marketing? Again, they both seem to talk about the products they sell all day long. And I love that question because it gets to the heart of it, but you still have to be willing to hand that over. So that's where my career's taken me, which is first just telling people what to do, then doing it, then designing products to do it, and then finding better ways to talk about what is actually being done so that more people can understand why and how and when and where to do something.
So interesting. Obviously, right? You've done so much, especially early on in your career. Like, What are some of the things that you think you picked up on from different advantages, distinctions that helped you excel in the field of marketing specifically, right? I think it's pretty clear to me, right? Starting an SME, doing some selling yourself, connecting those dots, but would love to hear more from you there.
Oh man, there's several of those. And this is where the challenge of a podcast is I want a whiteboard over here and I'd start writing something down. Nobody can read my handwriting. And by the way, if you watch me at the
whiteboard, the same way.
I can't spell if you're watching me write. I mean, it's amazing. My ability to properly spell just completely disappears. But I'm actually going to back up. Years ago, I did a program at Oxford University. So it was at St. Edmund's Hall predominantly, but St. Anthony's College was where, and I took a tutorial there when I was an undergraduate. And tutorials at Oxford mean it's just one-on-one with faculty members. And I met the faculty member the first time, and she said, fantastic, I'll enjoy working with you. And she handed me three books. And she said, good, go read these, and I'll see you next week, and I want a 10-page paper from you. So I go sit down at a pub because I'm in England, and where else am I going to do my reading instead of my apartment? And I read the books, and I come back with my 10-page paper. And she said, and I'm handing her the document. She says, no. Stand up and read it to me. And it was an amazing experience. I'd never read my work out loud. And I realized that some of my writing was atrocious at times. It really was. And I took that to heart. And luckily, I would actually start editing my paper in my head while reading to her. So what I said to her never perfectly matched what I'd written because I'd realized, wow, the transition there is terrible. Or, oh, you forgot to bring in this little point from this particular author, anything like that. And so I would just read it to her. So that's the first one, just from a pure marketing perspective, as you're writing stuff up. And I still remember Reed Tossig was the CEO of Calidus when I was there. And I had snuck into our boardroom and I was actually testing a deck for the sales team to use that I'd written. And I was just presenting it in an empty room. And he comes in and he said, what are you doing? I said, I was doing the demo and presentation to make sure the talk track synced and flowed. And he just gave me this look of, oh. And that type of practice, I think a lot of marketers don't do that. Just you think what you've written is brilliant, and it might be, but read it out loud. See if it flows off the tongue, especially if you're then going to hand it over to sales and expect them to deliver that talk. Can sales deliver that talk? And I even took that further. I did a guest lecture in a communications class at the business school at Mirage. And I walked in with the assignment. And the assignment that I gave was take a concept for your company, because this is, again, a part-time and executive MBA programs. Now, write the 5-page white paper that will never be read by anybody other than your competition, but it'll be some great SEO. Let's all face it. Nobody wants to read a 5-page white paper anymore. Short attention span theater out here. Now, I want you to take that same white paper and turn it into a PowerPoint deck. Identical information. Now do it in images, but don't just dump words on the page. Matter of fact, this is where I always quote Guy Kawasaki, who is arguably my first like luminary that I followed when he wrote the Macintosh Way. I had the first Mac 128, and when Macintosh Way came out, and I still have my copy is somewhere here in my home office with my like underlines and post-it notes that are falling apart when I was writing my first business plan based on
him. That's so cool.
And I remember a talk he gave where he said, take the average age of your audience divided by 2. That's the smallest font size you can have on the screen. And I actually still follow that today. I try not to, if I can't fit words on the screen at a 20-point font size, then I don't put them in. It's too many words. Nobody wants to have a PowerPoint read to them. So I told my students, take your white paper, put it on this, keep it to 10 slides also. Nobody wants a 75-slide deck. And I realize anybody's listening to this who sat through my presentations is going to call me out as a hypocrite because I show up with these 50-slide decks because everything's interesting to me and I can't slow down and I talk quickly. So I'm like, no, I can get through 50 slides. Trust me. So I do that. Then I said, okay, great. You got your deck? Now I've got the next assignment. I wanted a blog post, an interesting-to-read blog post, a personalized blog post. Done with that? Great. Now make it an email. And you can't scroll past it. So it'll have a character count. And then now make it an email that I can read on the phone, which means, by the way, the character count on the title of the email has to fit on the average smartphone. And I've had to change this a few times as smartphones have gotten the big phones and little phones, but the same idea. You don't want it to scroll. Great. Yep. Now, and I'll date myself with this, now make it a tweet or equivalency. Nowadays, we'd probably make it a LinkedIn post. Each one of those, can you condense your message down to each step. It's back to the old elevator pitch, though. They used to talk the elevator pitch, but I hate the elevator pitch because then reps will just speak back marketing speak. Instead of an elevator pitch, I always say, and I'll steal this from Imran Khurram, who's a professor of marketing. He used to finish a three-hour lecture with, "You're at a cocktail party tonight, and someone says, oh, you're in school. What did you learn today?" He's, "Now let's say, what are the three things you're going to say you learned today?" And he would take 3 hours, and he was willing to boil it down to three bullets. And that's how he would finish every lecture. And it was brilliant. And I tried to tell the sales reps, don't tell me the elevator pitch. Don't tell me the opening of an SDR, BDR, ADR call. Tell me what you tell a friend. Says, "Hey, what are you doing nowadays? What does your company do?" How would you respond in a natural language format that makes it sound like you actually care about the product, that makes it sound like it's interesting, that won't bore the person at the Little League game or on the sidelines of a soccer game or over an adult beverage at New Year's party or something like that? How do you synthesize what you're doing that makes it sound like you actually care, you're interested? So each one of those is what's come from throughout my career of like on the marketing and messaging side. Now, as a marketer, one of my strengths I feel is I've carried a bag. And I usually say some of the best marketers are failed sales reps. And I put failed in quote marks because maybe they just couldn't close. Maybe they had a bad territory. Maybe they're part of the fact that we accept that 20 to 25% of our sales reps will churn every year. By the way, I can go off on a rant on that subject that I think it's a horrible management of salespeople that we go into it assuming that half won't make quota and a quarter to a third will churn every year.
You're telling me over here, my man.
That drives me insane. But I do think carrying a bag or at least doing ride-alongs with sales. You can see on my LinkedIn that I worked for Canon for a while. And that was on the business product side, including copiers, multifunction printers. Someone at Canon's going to shoot me a nasty note. And they're absolutely right. Those things have got more power than the computers I owned growing up and writing code in. But going into that, and there was nothing like going out with a rep and going to a customer visit to get a feel for what it's like in reality. And I think I've known companies where marketing and sales aren't even in the same building. Marketing and sales should be intermeshed. I used to grab my laptop and go sit in the SDR bullpen. And I would just roll my chair back and say, "Don't," and just listen to them as they're dialing for dollars, trying to get connections. And I'd hear as they'd say something. And if I heard something that didn't quite click, I was like, "Hey, can we take a quick pause? You're following up on leads from this event or this webinar." Well, in my case, I'm the one that spoke there. And it looks like by the time I gave my talk and somebody else wrote up the brief that they attached to the campaign and gave you the names, the message has been lost. So let me tell you what I really said, not what somebody else synthesized. And by sitting there, we would get more connections. It would just tell like, "Oh, thank you. You've given me, now I get it. Now I understand what happened." So if you're not listening as a marketer to how sales is actually delivering your story without critiquing, "Why did you say that?" No, listen to them. There's probably a reason sales is going down that particular path. I always say one of my favorite things is I hate a final slide that just says thank you. Nah, if it's the final slide, let it have the cheat sheet, the summary, or even stuff you didn't have time to talk about, plus your contact information. I've done that one more than once, and I built one of those. And the rep's like, "It was great because we were going down this side of it. And all of a sudden I had a CFO say, hold it. What's that thing about auditability? Because we didn't talk about that. Oh yeah, we have this audit trail and this, and we can create the journal records and we can make it very easy so that if your external auditors want to look at what's going on, this tiny look," which is not the core value of the product, but it was to the CFO. It wasn't part of the pitch, but it was on just a closing slide that just sat behind the rep actually in those days in a live meeting. Q&A shouldn't say Q&A time. It should be the summary of what you hopefully have imparted throughout a 30-minute meeting and a demo. Or again, you lose the talk and then you take notes of, "Wow, next time I should bring that back up higher if I have that persona in the room." Because you can do all the persona training you want in the world, but until you hit it in the marketplace, you're not necessarily going to connect.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's super, super interesting stuff. And I think it kind of bridges well into what I was thinking about next, which is like super curious to hear your perspective on the current state of marketing and kind of where you think it's going in the future. I think it's really interesting because a lot of the companies that I talk with today, marketing is starting to get more and more skin in the game, right? Having metrics that they're actually being held to, that are being quantified, having more of a seat at the table, if you will. So would love to hear your perspective there, because I think there's a lot changing right now in the world of go-to-market.
There is a huge change, and I've been watching for the last few years, and it's been very interesting. I've long had the statement, if it matters, you've got to be able to measure it. Well, once you can objectively, not subjectively, objectively measure it, you should remunerate. That's my attempt to get three M's in there. Closest I can do is remunerate. Or I can just say money, but that's too crass. Which means marketing should be on a quarterly incentive program the same way the sales reps are. Now, there are risks there. And that incentive program, it probably should be at its most basic level, say pipeline generation. Now, what is pipeline generation? And we can get into, I personally believe that marketing qualified leads don't exist, in that I like to measure at sales qualified opportunity creation. Well, you should measure the whole funnel. But if I'm gonna pay somebody a bonus, I personally believe it should be based at the sales qualified, where a rep has said, there is gold in them thar hills, and has put a dollar or pound or euro figure on it, or yen, since I just got back from Japan, figure on it. Put a monetary figure on what I think this deal might be worth. And you should be snapshotting that and keeping an eye on it and measuring how much of your eventual closed won business comes from marketing. Now, the problem with that mindset, and it's, so we do have the mindset of tracking marketing based on pipeline generation. Companies are starting to accept the fact that you could put marketing on a more variable pay program to really recognize that. The risk is, let's talk about the marketing we've just completely ignored. We're missing brand here. Yep. We're missing outreach. We're missing social media shares and things like that. And if you get, I am worried, and I do feel that the pendulum has swung very strongly towards measurable demand generation metrics. And I even think some of the newer CMOs that I see rising up are people who are very good with a marketing ops type perspective. And they know all the tools, the stack of tools that are going out there. They know the open and close rates. They're great at SEO. They're fantastic at using the website and chatbots and bringing them in campaign management, and what money you spend in the campaigns, and what's the best ROI. And I agree with all that. What it can miss out, though, is the secondary effects that we're still not great at measuring. And that could be, let's talk about a big event. Let's talk about Salesforce's Dreamforce. I love Dreamforce. I mean, it is, there was a year where I didn't go, and the number of texts I had from people from multiple firms saying, hey, Eric, do you have 5 minutes? I was going to swing by your booth, catch up with you, or we're having a dinner tonight. Would you like to join us? I got one extra seat. I know you're not my ICP, but I'd love to have you there because I know you're fun at a conversation and you can play along with my prospects, all that stuff. I'm like, I'm sorry, I didn't make it this year. And this is this universal, what? What do you mean you didn't make it this year? How could you not be walking around Moscone Center right now for this event? And it was. However, measuring Dreamforce, how much did that custom booth cost? How much did the hotels cost? How much did the flights cost? You know, fully staffed? Did you get a speaking slot? How many badge scans did you get, and all of that? And if you just measured on that, you might go, wow, I spent a lot of money. With that much money, I could have just poured it all into Google Ads and gotten the same number of clicks. Right. But if you were in the Salesforce ecosystem, using that as the example, and you're not at Dreamforce, you're making a statement. But it's hard to measure the impact of that positive or negative statement. And I've seen that before. It's like when people say, hey, because what's one of the most expensive parts of marketing? Field, events, all of those things like that. But the association, and I should use the word attribution, because I feel like attribution is still one of those things we're all still fighting to come up with the perfect way of giving it. Because even if you measure every touch to every person at every company, you still don't necessarily know what truly created the opportunity and what truly created the close and where all the pieces are in between. But that's what worries me. So yes, demand generation is critical, and you've got to have that dialed in. You've got to know where you can turn the dial at any point in time. If the CFO comes in and says, hey, it would actually be really good if you could spend some money right now, which does happen. There are CFOs that are like, we try to keep a certain cost point. And if you pulled together some costs right now, and maybe they're even good enough to look at forecasts and a sales forecast of this is going to be a really good quarter. I would rather you spent it now than next quarter that we think is going to be down a little bit. So I'm going to ask you to throttle back next quarter. So can you go spend $25,000 right now in a way that will create pipeline for the next 2 to 3 quarters, but I don't want that expense on the books next quarter. And I've been in those conversations. But again, that's not looking at the brand. That's not looking at the image. That's not looking at what's the value of a really good share on LinkedIn. Can you measure it? And somebody's listening and going, yes, we'll use a UTM and we'll track that link. And yeah, but people don't necessarily. If I see a really cool piece on LinkedIn, I don't click on the link. I look at the company name and I type in the company name in a separate browser. Heck, I might even put it on an incognito browser, depending upon just to avoid the cookies hitting me, or I'm running multiple ad blockers. I mean, I'm a marketing guy that runs ad blocking because sometimes I just want to see what's going on. I don't want you targeting me. I want to get your wider message, not the narrow one that you think I care about automatically. So I think it's a beautiful day for marketing in that we can measure more stuff than we ever could. I worry about losing perspective on the harder to measure stuff that I can't prove, but I know in my gut is still very important.
Yeah, so, so interesting. And you hit on the attribution piece a little bit, and like, it's a huge challenge. I talk to marketers every day. It's something that it feels like every company is struggling with. What are your thoughts there? What are some approaches that you've had maybe at Exactly or that you've given to other companies through consulting to try and tackle such a tricky issue, right? That I think software can't really fully fix today.
So, I mean, first is truly to at least track it. And I'll still remember this is a deal years ago that we closed. And I went into a QBR, an exec QBR. And it's funny, I'd had an argument with our CMO at the time. And I'm like, no, we should be looking at all the touches that led to these. He's, no, don't go down that path. And I knew our CEO would want it. And so I built the exhibits anyway. And the CEO's like, yeah, but where did these all come from? I smile and I just said, well, I've actually got that. And my CMO is looking daggers at me. And I just popped up like our top 5 big money deals. And all I had done is gone into Salesforce and manually looked at every single touch going back. And he laughed. He said, hold it. You're telling me the first touch at this account was 7 years ago on this webinar from this person? Yes. Wow, that's still paying dividends. Now, was that accurate? Do you really say? No, that's just the first time they raised their hand. I mean, I could look at badge scans at Dreamforce and do the same thing, or webinar attendance. And then you get into personas. And so first, just do you have the data? And I'm just going to say, do you have the data? Then you got to decide how to look at it. And you might have gotten their attention. You've got their interest. They know you exist as a company. And that's the first thing. So first, get the data. Sorry. Second, determine the window of data you're going to look at. And it's going to have to be an arbitrary number. So no, the fact that we have scanned this person has come by our booth, or this company versus person has come by our booth every year at Dreamforce. I'm going to keep on flogging that Dreamforce line, because it's easy to replace it with any other core event to your line of business. Just because they keep coming by, I'm not going to give 5 years at Dreamforce credit for this, but I'm going to remember it at least and note it. So then, and actually that's where it's interesting, the modern cookie tracking, although that's all getting broken right now, but you might even look at all of the anonymous stuff. And that's the stuff that companies like Sixth Sense do, or in ZoomInfo does, and a few other amazing players in that stalking thing, interest. That's one side of it. What created the opportunity in the sense of, but you might not even create the opportunity. You're just creating awareness. And then when that particular prospect finally says, you know what? Do need a left-handed pink wrench. And I know somebody that makes left-handed pink wrenches. I'm going to look at them. So there's your first piece. But then you've got all the touches in between. So maybe they even start an opportunity, but you're still doing some webinars, or you're still publishing some white paper. So let's say the opportunity is created, but they download one of the white papers 3 days later or 3 months later, if it's a longer cycle. Little credit there. Now, what was the final few touches before the close? Was it just sales, or were they, again, pulling down a Forrester Wave or a Gartner Magic Quadrant or a Ventana Value Index that mentions your company, and maybe it's even your link? Or maybe you don't know if they did that because they already have a contract with Gartner, so they pulled it down directly from Gartner. Or worse, one of your sales reps has downloaded it, saved it as a PDF on their laptop, and they just mailed it out, so you have zero tracking. So my personal bias is almost towards a horseshoe. I probably have one hanging somewhere in this room. Actually, I know where it's just not hanging right now. Where it's like there's all the stuff that got their interest and brought them in. Then if I had to do credit, it's like, I don't know, 25% credit to the thing that actually got the interest in the door where they started taking calls. And then another percent of that maybe was the last touch before the opportunity was created, and some trickle on percentages for all the other tools and assets and things used up until the close. Now that's thinking like enterprise. Now, remember, the smaller business you get into, it can just be, we went to one show, we met the person, got the scan, SDR booked a meeting, rep gave a demo, closed one. So some of those smaller businesses tend to be much more nimble in making decisions, so it's a little harder. But once you start growing into larger and larger firms, and I mean, I think of the people, who are the people at the table? Is it, you got finance, you might have HR, you've got COO, someone in RevOps, and a couple others. And being able to track every one of those touches to each one of those personas, and we all talk about persona marketing, it's hard. And you're just going to have to make an arbitrary, like, how long does marketing get credit? So maybe marketing creates, opportunity happens, and then it dies, and it goes nowhere. So then they go into a nurture campaign. But then one day, the new head of the SDR team, the lead gen team, comes in and says, we're going to do a wake the dead operation, stealing a line from Sixth Sense, I'll admit. So Latanya, their new CRO, apologies and cheers to you. We're doing a wake the dead operation. We're going to just call old opportunities that ended in no decision. So that's a lead generation created opportunity, not marketing. Even though the reason they're in the wake the dead file was marketing activities, it's now lead generation that makes it happen. But you still want to keep an eye on that because marketing did get their attention. This is what I mean, where attribution is so complicated. And absolutely, if you get too much, oh, and by the way, a partner helped us in that deal who's doing some work over there, and they're going to do the implementation because we have partner-led implementations or referrals. And do we give partner credit? And so overlapping credit, and then everybody screams, well, then everybody gets credit, so nobody gets credit.
Right. And if we're going to start paying marketers based on this sort of thing, right, it's like, how do we do this?
Right. Was this a marketing? And I had a person on my team, we used to call it, she used to say, I'm doing dumpster diving, which is to go into all opportunities created and see if they're properly tagged, because certain CRMs are terrible. Whoever, when the opportunity is created, it tends to be off of one person. And if that person, though, was not the core person that's picked up all the marketing materials, even though then all of a sudden it's a raw opportunity with no touches. Hold it. Why don't you have this person involved in it? Then you'll suddenly see all these touches that have happened. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. And even half the time sales, yeah, of course. All I was doing was my job was creating the opportunity because I was talking to Eric and making it happen. It's, yeah, but we lost all the other touches if you don't include these other people in it. Do they belong in there? And that's where like account, all the touches in the account versus all the touches of the people who are listed in the opportunity, and you can lose a lot of data in there. And actually, that's part of where I'm really excited about, believe it or not, AI. I think AI attribution that will really start training AI to dig through all that data and come back and say, hey, here's every touch. And to be able to sit there and say, that's great. Can you filter it to say all the touches into the finance team and all the touches into the revenue operations team and all the touches into here? Great. Now, can you filter that based on recency effect? Plus also, can you give me an underlying bar of just general intent data that Sixth Sense or Zoom Info is providing to me? Sure. And I think there's going to be some fascinating AI plays here going forward that are going to help us with that attribution. It's still going to be clear as mud, but I think it won't be that bad. But it'll at least give you all of those different pieces of touches, not just so that you can pay somebody, because the whole reason to pay somebody is so they'll do more. And this is where I have a talk that I give on the difference between incentives and rewards. An incentive changes your behavior. A reward thanks you for being a contributing part of the operation. Profit sharing plans are rewards. Nobody changes their behavior at the office because they're on a profit sharing plan. Nobody says, I'm only grabbing one donut because that second donut will go to the bottom line and then I won't get a profit. Nah, I mean, I'm sorry. There might be one person, but in reality, nobody's thinking that way. But rewards are important because it makes people feel a part of the organization. They feel like they're sharing the wealth. I mean, that's the Silicon Valley is created off of stock options. stock options didn't change people's behavior. It made them really feel a part of the organization. Incentives, though, get you to set your alarm 30 minutes earlier. And it might get you to work through lunch or to take that extra call or to check Slack at 7 p.m. while you're watching sports ball, depending on the season. That's what an incentive does. Incentives, however, are amoral. They drive behavior. It might not be the behavior you want. So yeah, if we do put marketing on pure demand generation incentive base, expect marketing to only do things that are demand generation incentive base, and they're going to be hunting down for that quote credit. And if you only allow single credit, you're going to have marketing versus alliances. Let's just say alliances like, hey, we're hosting a cocktail party as part of Salesforce World Tour with three other partners, and we're going to scan these people and we should get credit for this. And marketing's, well, yes, but we're the ones that sent out the emails. So we actually think partner marketing should get it, not the business development team. And then all of a sudden you have the con. And you want, and this goes back to something, a talk I gave at a Marketo show of lead source is a lie, because lead source is so often a single point in time as opposed to the spread spectrum of there. A talk I gave that said lead source is a lie. Because lead source too often in our current systems only reflects a single moment in time, not all of the touches that took place. And that's where we have to be careful. If we put too much money behind all of this, too much focus on just one thing, you've got to look at all the parts. Just start by trying to see what you can see. Then that'll put you in a better place. But be wary. If not, like all of a sudden, again, what's the value of a press release? Honestly, you can watch like little spikes in web traffic sometimes. It's good for SEO in the sense that people kind of find you. PR agencies aren't free. A really good corporate communications person deserves a good salary because they can do great stuff. What's the value of that? And that's the stuff that worries me, is there stuff that I know has value. And I'm sure there'll be somebody that'll shoot me a note like, hey, here's how we measure the effectiveness, share of voice and all that. Yeah, but can we measure that all the way to opportunity creation where sales close business? That's when you're going to have to really make it happen and pull it all together.
Yeah, that was super, super interesting, right? And I think the other part of it is like, you can't lose sight of creative and brand and these other things, right? Like you need to be doubling down in those areas and you can't be butting heads across the marketing team.
Right. And across the sales team, sales should be brought into that. Marketing should have, I've run marketing meetings where we had a special guest star sitting in the room as just one person from the sales team. Just let them sit and listen. And then let them throw in 5 minutes of their own feedback at the end with no pushback. And same thing again, marketing, go hang out with sales, not just at the bar. Go to a sales QBR and listen to them complaining about problems of moving to a particular product or the leads are terrible. I mean, look, we know sales is going to say the leads are terrible. There's never enough leads for sales. And marketing is going to say that's because you're not following up on the good leads that I gave you. But let's dig into that together. Be partners, not adversaries inside the company.
Absolutely. And I'm curious, Eric, what are your thoughts on account-based marketing as a whole and kind of like where it stands in the industry today? I mean, from my perspective as someone who's selling an ABM platform, more and more companies are starting to buy in, right? And realize that it is crucial to their go-to-market. And the ones that haven't and are still selling with the old lead-based model are really starting to fall behind, but would love to hear your perspective.
I'm always shocked when somebody isn't embracing ABM, bluntly, because, again, the idea of the single buyer, unless, again, I'm just doing a donut delivery service to your office. But even that, I'm going to have to get someone in HR and somebody in one other team that is the one that actually likes the donuts. And that is still going to happen. And I think there is this problem of people need to that. This is another reason why if you don't believe in ABM, then you haven't sat down with sales and said, so who all was in that room? I think some of this was lost when we went all sales being done over a video call and we weren't necessarily capturing all the people there, because I still think of some of my favorite sales calls that I've gone on where walked into a room and they had set up the U-shaped table and there was 25 people in that room. We brought five. They brought another 20 representing multiple departments. And I just started writing down as people are introducing themselves. I was quickly writing down who they were and the types of questions. And I brought that back. That was account based. And if you're not hitting, it's a persona based, but it's personas that add up to the full account. You have got to have all those different touches. And worse, or more importantly, depending upon how you look at it, you have to understand they have different perspectives. Finance sees things differently from marketing and sales. And even in finance, controllers might see a different thing from accounts payable and accounts receivable, depending upon what you're selling. Operations sees it differently. All of those different groups have a different core perspective, and that's going to come in. And I'll do a simplistic one, and I'm going to go back to the multifunction printers, the copiers. And there was one account talking to a Canon, and it was great because they were saying how long it takes for the page to come off the device mattered in one hallway, because that's where the executive's office was. And there was a C-suite person who wanted to hit print on their computer and walk out and have the copy sitting there. However, there was an ops person who was really focused on energy usage and almost an ESG perspective. And basically having the multifunction printer always on and hot takes more energy. So they liked the little delay for a lot of the machines. Let the machine then come up to speed, warm up, boot up, or not true boot up, but all of that stuff. It's kind of like IT telling you that your laptop needs to lock down as soon as you walk away. And if they walk up to your laptop and it's still logged in, they will lock you out of your laptop because you're violating security. Look, I was grabbing a cup of coffee. You're costing me another 45 seconds of putting my password in that you won't let me use the same password twice. Da, 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 da. That slows down productivity. So you've got these conflicts. Well, account-based marketing needs to understand that an ops person might care about that boot cycle, or an IT person might care about the security, but the person over here in sales might actually care about being able to jump right back onto their laptop because they forgot about a meeting. They're rushing with a cup of coffee or back from the bathroom to get on that next sales call.
Nope.
And they can't get it. Or that C-suite person wants to know why that extremely confidential print job that they just sent isn't waiting for them in the tray, because they know how long it takes to walk from their office to the device. So they're willing to risk that piece of paper sitting there. And again, somebody will say, well, we now have it so you can hold your Apple Watch up to the device and then it'll print your paper for you. That's great. But those different needs and desires, I'm trying to do this as an analogy, is why ABM is so important. And I think there's companies that are getting ABM, but they're still not doing a good job of separating out the messaging for each one of those influencers, buyers, champions, users, et cetera, at both a current client or a prospective client. And ABM continues even after the sale. You got to keep the customer happy nowadays. Keep them involved, keep them referred. You want them, if they change companies, to come around and say, no, I used you at this firm, that sort of a thing.
No, totally. Right. Keeping an eye on, right, are they searching for competitors or other use cases we can solve for 100%?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I guess to kind of close things out here, what are some like good reads that you've had, like good books, blogs, newsletters, videos, anything that you might recommend to our listeners?
Oh, man, I'm a bad person to ask because I've got like 500 bookmarks that I bounce around.
I figured you would.
I follow. And I mean, I will say I read the analyst reports and not just the ones about me. I mean, and because one of the things I've done for years is I've managed analyst relations at a couple different companies. It's wonderful. So I'm on the email lists from some of these firms and they'll send me stuff like, hey, we just published this blog. Thought you might be interested in it. And I've even had a great sales rep from the analyst firms that will send me a summary of the interesting stuff in case I wasn't searching through it. So I'll always try to read those. And here's why, because my prospects and customers are reading those. Now then, on other things, if I look around here, I've been grabbing books on AI recently. I won't walk away from the microphone to try and remember the titles of a couple of them. I have a stack of them sitting behind me on a shelf that I'm going through. A lot of AI, but I'm interested in where it's going, what it's doing. I follow academic research. I'm, again, very interested in how you push sales and marketing together. And I've got a couple friends in that space. Michael Ahern at the University of Houston, for example, is an old friend, and we've been doing some joint research. And so I'm always keeping an eye on the stuff he's talking about and doing. I go to an academic conference that's every other year. That's a collection of faculty and the graduate students doing research on sales organizations. And I love those conferences to hear what's going on. But I also will follow the startup world. I mean, I still think Peter Thiel's 0 to 1 is a great book to read. I was talking to somebody and they're like, what was the first business book you read? And I keep on saying it was Guy Kawasaki's The Macintosh Way. And Guy's always has something fun and interesting to say in this world. After that, you know, other other pieces. I'm part of a couple different Slack groups, like, you know, RevOps Squared and Rev Genius. I like to see what's going on there. World at Work, which is still the preeminent for sales compensation and things like that. And I love, and their rewards, I love, you know, I'm a member of that organization, and their summaries can be very interesting of things that are coming out there. And after that, I almost depend on SEO. It's kind of funny where I start getting pointed at some interesting blogs and things like that. And actually, blogging's another one of those things we were talking about. Is blogging matter? Well, that's a tough one. I mean, you can look at traffic to your blog. If I'm reading your blog from my iPhone while on a Targetify, while I'm waiting for someone to check if something's in stock, so I've adapted the modern mantra of any second standing around, I'm going to read. Flipping through it, do you really know that I was doing that? Do you have me cookied off my phone? Probably not. But I'm still reading it. And, oh, they have something interesting to say. So I'd like to look at some of the corporate blogs, and I get stuff that gets sent over to me in that direction as well.
Cool. What about someone or like some people that have inspired you throughout your career or you're just joining through life?
Ooh, that's a really good one. I love founder CEOs. I mean, I'll admit, Chris Cabrera and I work together and we're still good friends, but Scott Broomfield over at Blueboard, I mean, he was our CFO and then ran a product and became CMO at Exactly before moving on to a couple other things. He and I get along. Mary Shea, I knew her when she was an analyst at Forrester, and then she has done a couple different things, a couple different companies. I stay in touch with her as well. I think she always has something interesting out there. Bill Bauer at SBR Consulting in London is great. The folks over at Simon Kucher, which is a consulting firm, I like their perspective along with ZS Associates. I like some of the consulting firms, and I feel like because they're very intelligently sharing their knowledge, and by doing that, of course, that's going to drive business for them. So don't get me wrong. We're all mercenaries. It's all for money. But I also like how they come in and do things like that. But yeah, I mean, the pure inspirations, I've got the Steve Jobs book. I mean, like I said, the Macintosh changed my perspective. I wrote code back in the late 80s and into the early 90s. And I enjoyed it. I just realized that wasn't my personality to sit and write it, but I love making the puzzle pieces fit together. And that's what always like, so like finding some ways. I really like the people though that know how to talk on these subjects and have embraced the thing. Like Nick Mehta at Gainsight. God, I love Nick's perspective and attitude on things and the way he approaches business challenges, but also embraces like what's going on at the firm. I've always liked how he goes into those pieces as well to continue making things that are going to make a difference and have that direct narrowed impact. I think I already mentioned Peter Thiel, 0 to 1. I knew Peter as an undergrad, and he and I trade barbs over email a couple times a year and enjoy harassing him a little bit. And he harasses me back with a much larger voice, I'll freely admit. And there's a few other investors out there. Trevor Loy runs a VC fund out of New Mexico. Why do I like that? Well, it's the idea of, and Trev puts it like fishing where nobody else is fishing. And basically, hey, there's more people out there coming up with some great things. You don't just have to chase Silicon Valley and Austin, let's just say. It's a wider market. And I still remember when Route 128 out of Boston was the home of technology long before. And then it lost out to Silicon Valley, but it's in a resurgence now. Yeah, Tracer Kidder's Soul of a New Machine was assigned to me as a freshman in college. So that book still sits stuck in my skull. Harika Schneer, who's the business school at Stanford, it's a great guy. Sanjay Mishra up at the University of Chicago Booth School. Alan Benson at the Carlson School of Management. He and I have done some projects together. I love what he's looked at and who gets promoted in the sales organization. He's written some stuff on the modern day Peter principle. So I'm bouncing around because I'm always interested in somebody that's got a new, interesting perspective that is backed by some data.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be perfect data, just backed by any sort of interesting information where you're suddenly capturing, oh, you've got something here and you found a solution or you found a pattern. You found how people work together. And I am very interested in how you get people to really embrace and chase it. Adam Nash, who is the senior product guy at LinkedIn, has gone off and he's done a couple of things. He actually now has a program to make charitable donations even better. I'm blanking on the name right now, and I'm not going to sit there and type away and try to remember where Adam is. Adam had this old blog years ago on the importance of t-shirts in Silicon Valley. And why release t-shirts and things like that mattered, because it showed like this constant movement and it also brought a community together. And then even admittedly, there's a little bit of the challenge of the flex of, oh, you have that shirt on? I mean, I was sad. I had a System 7 t-shirt from Apple that finally wore out, and I had to sadly retire it. But because nobody under a certain age knows what System 7 was, but it was such a huge shift in the Macintosh OS community. And heck, I had a Nextbox at one point. I loved how that approached making tech available to everybody. And nowadays, I'm following anybody really seems to be thinking about, hey, that's the next one. And I think the modern AI and the fact that it's available to more people is going to be one of the biggest changes. It's not, we've had AI for years. There's been all sorts of tools for years. But right now we're at a situation, it's kind of like the web browser made the web available for everybody. I mean, I remember dial up to FTP sites to download stuff long before Netscape went out. But then Netscape comes out and the whole web is available to everybody. AI has done the same thing. The new generative AI, ChatGPT, Google Bard, etc., that are out. Those are the two that I play with, admittedly. And I can use AI from my browser. Anybody can use AI now. Anybody can license an AI engine. And I think we're going to see that spread. And that's going to be amazing. So I will follow anybody that's talking about interesting applications of AI. And the risk factors. There are risk factors, don't get me
wrong. Absolutely. And then, Eric, to close things out, how can people get in touch with you after the podcast?
Probably the best way is LinkedIn. And this is where I say it's Eric Charles. It's E-R-I-K-C-H-A-R-L-E-S. And you'll either find me or Eric Chainsaw Charles, who is a MMA fighter, still runs a pack of gyms and does some advisory work out of the New York area. He and I have traded notes because I was like,
that is too buddy.
But you definitely can tell the difference because he's a big cut MMA guy, even though he's been out of that space for a bit. And I definitely am not. LinkedIn is probably the best way to chase me down, or you can just get me at Eric Charles, E-R-I-K-C-H-A-R-L-E-S @Gmail, because I'm old enough to have grabbed my full name on Google when they first made Gmail available.
I got mine as well. I feel good about that. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Eric. It was such a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, thank you very much as well. Thanks for the invitation and happy to talk again.
Awesome. Have a great day.
You as well.
Today's episode is made possible by DemandBase. DemandBase is smarter GTM for B2B brands to help marketing and sales teams spot the juiciest opportunities earlier and progress them faster. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Sunnyside Up. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us and subscribe to our show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you consume podcasts. You can also find us on YouTube and DemandBase TV.